Hello, everybody, and welcome to this bonus episode on the Rewatch Project with Hannah and Mike feed. This is available on YouTube and on the regular podcast feed. And this is a small sorbet of sorts between our coverage of the first and second season of the original run of Twin Peaks. And in the spirit of that, here is a conversation I had with co-creator of said show, Mark Frost. I originally recorded this audio on my other podcast, the Shinstroker versus Punter podcast, back in, I would say, around 2012. So enjoy. I think this is pretty evergreen content and fits nicely in this run of the show, as we have just covered an episode written and directed by said Mark Frost. So enjoy, and we will be back very soon with the beginning of our coverage of season two of Twin Peaks. Thank you. We are very lucky to have with us screenwriter, producer, director, novelist, sports enthusiast, and co-creator of Twin Peaks, Mr. Mark Frost. Thank you for joining us this evening, Mark.
Glad to be with you. Thanks.
Awesome. I mean, as a long-term Twin Peaks fan, and due to a lot of the shout-outs that I've got over Twitter this evening, I'm going to be sort of concentrating quite a lot on Twin Peaks, but as I realise your time's a premium, I do want to hopefully get the opportunity to talk about some of your other work as well. First and foremost, I mean, in relation to Twin Peaks, I mean, you've said numerous times that you first met David in 1986 after establishing a successful writing career with scripts for $6 Million Man and Hill Street Blues. Now, you collaborated on a number of unproduced scripts during this period. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about these?
Sure. Well, the first thing we worked on together was an adaptation of a book by a pretty well-known British journalist named Anthony Summers, a book about Marilyn Monroe called Goddess, which was the first really definitive biography about Marilyn that kind of put her in her in perspective, and her relationship revealed her relationship with the Kennedys, and kind of brought to light a lot of the darker side of what her life had been like in the last decade of her life. And that movie was set up at United Artists. I was scheduled to write, and David was attached to direct it, and that was the project that we first met on. The script did not go forward at United Artists, but we got along so well that we decided to collaborate on a script together, a rather infamous unproduced screenplay called One Saliva Bubble that David and I wrote from 86 to into 87. And we just had the best time working on it. It was going to be a film for Dino De Laurentiis, where David had his deal at that time. And we were about, I'd say, 6 weeks away from the start of pre-production and had made, I don't know if we concluded the deals, but we'd certainly looked like we were going to be making the movie with Steve Martin and Martin Short. And wow. Then all of a sudden, Dino De Laurentiis' company went bankrupt. And as they slipped slowly into Chapter 11, they kept One Saliva Bubble in their clutches, so we didn't get the rights back to it for many, many years, and then by that point the moment had kind of come and gone. So after those two experiences, I think, if I remember the chronology, is when we were first approached by one of our mutual agents to see if we might be interested in creating something in the television world, and that of course led to Twin Peaks.
I've got to ask, Mark, I've often wondered, I don't know whether this is something that you've gone on the record about before, but I mean, I've read the book Goddess myself, and I can't help but wonder, I mean, were there elements of that bled over into the character of Laura Palmer, the idea of the beautiful woman who seems to have everything, but there's maybe some sort of, you know, worms under the grass there? Was there a conscious element there, or was that just something that you guys were drawn towards?
It's interesting. I don't remember consciously drawing on the Marilyn myth for Laura, but I think Marilyn Monroe is such a powerful, iconic figure in our culture and even in our subconscious that the notion of a woman like that in trouble probably did influence or become an interest that we shared, exploring from a narrative standpoint. And that did, I guess, there are some overlaps with Twin Peaks. The thing that influenced me, particularly with regard to Laura, was, two things in my own family history. I'm from upstate New York originally, and my family had always had a place around a small lake outside of Albany. And my grandparents had told me that many, many years before, I think around the early 1900s, there had been a famous unsolved murder case involving a young woman who I believe her name was Hazel Gray, who had been found on the banks of a lake. And she'd been staying at a boarding house nearby and worked in a small company. And I believe the murder was eventually solved, but for quite a while it wasn't. And that legend had kind of been a part of the lore of that little community that we lived in for a very long time. So I'd grown up hearing about that. That obviously had something to do with Laura Palmer in a conscious way when we sat down and created the character.
So when you and Davey started to develop the pilot script for what was then, I believe, called Northwest Passage, I've often tried to get a mental picture of this process. I mean, how would you yourself characterize the differences between yours and David's contributions to the creation and development of the show?
Well, it was very much a, I guess, like sitting down and writing a song. You know, somebody thinks of a phrase here, somebody thinks of a note there. It was very much a back and forth ping pong table kind of discussion. And I'd never collaborated with anybody before. I'd always written by myself. And I don't believe David had either. I think it was a first for both of us. Mm. But we found it to be a tremendously effortless kind of process. And it was also great fun because we made each other laugh a lot, and our senses of humor really line up. And as you probably know, writing can be a very lonely profession. So it was kind of a blast to be able to hang out and be productive at the same time. And the process of writing the pilot seemed like we were just going on a walk and finding things written on the backs of rocks and trees and leaves. I mean, it was so easy in a way and effortless that the project kind of wrote itself, if that makes sense.
Was there ever any kind of, spoken or otherwise, any sense of division of labor between the two of you? Was there ever, okay, you're the story guy, you're the character guy, you're the mood guy, or was that just something that was never sort of discussed or considered?
The biggest division of labor was probably I did the typing because David didn't type very well. But I guess later on when we got into the series, you know, and I was kind of doing the day-to-day running of the show, and he was, directing a movie and doing stuff, I took on probably more responsibility in that regard. But in the early stages when we wrote those first couple hours together, there wasn't any thought of that. And as we produced the pilot, you know, clearly David's one of the great directors I think we've ever produced. And you let a guy like that, you know, have his free reign. He does what he does. I, as a producer, tried to do as much as I could to consciously, you know, help the process along. And the casting was very much a collaboration. The scouting locations we did together. But, you know, once you get down to putting film in the camera and saying action, you just step back and you let a master go to work. And that's what I was, as a writer-producer, I was lucky enough to be able to let that happen.
From previous interviews with yourself, what I've seen, I mean, primarily on the bonus materials laden gold set that was released, that came out in the UK last year, you speak about the when you pitched the show to a to me, surprisingly responsive ABC. I mean, could you tell our listeners a little bit about that picture session? Because I've always had a mental picture almost kind of like the episode of Seinfeld where Jerry and George are pitching the show. And I was sort of wondering what the dynamic was like in that situation.
You know, it wasn't all that dissimilar. I would say receptive. I would also add the word desperate to a description of the network at that place and time. They were kind of completely mired in third place and had been for some time, back to those kind of quaint days when we really only had three networks here. And they, I guess, had made a corporate decision that they were willing to take chances. So they were receptive enough to roll the dice. And there was just something about the combination of us coming in that David brought, you know, this cachet from the independent world, and I had enough years under my belt and I'd just come off Hill Street Blues for 3 years, that made them feel sort of secure that I understood their baseline business, that they were willing to just say, yeah, let's take a flyer on this. And initially it was only a script commitment, so it wasn't really that big a risk. Each time we came back having completed a step, you know, they had to make another decision. They'd say, okay, we'll go produce the pilot. And then when the pilot came in and they were sort of staggered by the responses they were getting to it, they said, well, I guess we don't really have any choice but to put it on the air. But not enough that they were going to lead with it in their big fall rollout. They thought, well, probably nobody's going to want to watch this, so let's kind of let it go in April, when not a lot of new shows are coming on the air and people are tired of the junk they've been watching. So we'll take that chance. You know, they were always sort of, they were small bets that they were making. They never took the huge gamble. And then when the show hit the way it did, I think they were more surprised than anybody.
I mean, I was, I think, about 17 or 18 when the first season dropped. My first experience with it was with the infamous European pilot that was released as a rental video here, and it was promoted as somewhat erroneously as the new David Lynch film. Right. So I watched this, and then afterwards I was thinking, okay, that's very interesting. But obviously, there's the truncated element at the end there, and I understand obviously the logic that was at work there with that. And then it became, I remember hearing that this was actually going to TV. Now, I mean, when you were shooting the pilot, I mean, obviously there was a little bit of uncertainty. As demonstrated by the need to have this closed ending. I mean,
right?
How confident were you that the show was going to go to a full season or mid season replacement?
Well, I had a pretty good feeling about it. I just, everything had fallen into place so easily as we'd written it, and then the casting came together really beautifully. We found all the places in the real world that we'd written as if we'd already been describing places that we'd seen when in fact we'd never laid eyes on them. And as you started to watch the dailies and watch the scenes on the set, you got a sense that, wow, there's a little bit of lightning in a bottle here. You know, something could happen. The reason we had to do that closed ending was more about, the business arrangement that we'd made with a distributor, that in the event the show was not picked up, they wanted to know that they had a way to recoup their putting up the money to actually make the pilot.
Sure.
So it was a contractual obligation, and we came up with the scene for that ending really in a single day, and I think we shot it in a single day. And we talked about, you know, how could we possibly ever wrap this up? And it was obviously not meant for general consumption, but it somehow, that version escaped, and it's kind of out there ever since. But that was never intended to be the vision of the show that we had created. It was simply a necessity that allowed the show to to begin in the first place.
It's very tempting to be philosophical about how many interesting things came out of the notions that were explored in that ending.
It is. I mean, it did give us a notion of things that we were then able to explore in the series. So it definitely had a use for us. And I think that was the... Was that the first appearance of Little Mike? I think it was, wasn't it?
For the, I believe so, yeah.
So that was how he kind of came on the scene. And it helped kind of open the door to this otherworldly mythology that became a big part of the fabric of the show as we moved ahead.
One of the central images of Twin Peaks, I mean, a show, I mean, clearly, you know, rife with iconography, is that of the smiling homecoming queen. I mean, we see that image of Laura over the end titles of the majority of the episodes. Why do you feel that was so important? Why do you feel that image is so central to the show?
Well, this is in part hindsight, and it's also, I guess, in part how the show has since been viewed as a product of its time. But, you know, we were coming out of the Reagan era at that time, which in America, if you had a sense that that we were headed in the wrong direction, all you had to do was look up and see all this crazy kind of patriotic overkill going around you, and American flags flying, and this kind of celebration of the sometimes empty American iconography that I think Reagan was really adept at selling and representing. You could argue that tendency came to full fruition, you know, in the decades to come. But what we were exploring, I think, was what was underneath that imagery. What was America really like? It wasn't as plasticine as that shining, smiling homecoming queen picture. Life wasn't that perfect. It wasn't that serene. Something was going on underneath it. And I guess without really doing it fully consciously, we were picking images like that as a way of getting at what was going on beneath it. And in many ways, that's what the show was kind of about.
Sure that you're as aware of as anybody that the show has maintained a cult following, but that there does seem to be, I mean, I'm due to podcasting and writing in sort of the blogosphere, if you will, there does seem to have been over the last 3 or 4 years a real uptake of interest in Twin Peaks. Recently, last year, I went to the Battersea Arts Centre in London, where they did a full screening of the whole show. It was a 30-hour screening, and it was quite the scene. They'd had a gorgeous old theatre where they'd put a cinema screen up, and throughout the whole of the Arts Centre, there were bands playing, there were art installations going on, and it was really interesting to see Twin Peaks with an audience. And I experienced an almost Rocky Horror Show-esque call and response. And it was very interesting to see the moments that people reacted to, that people as a group reacted to. Now, I mean, this leads me on to one of the there were 3 or 4 episodes that hit really big. Now, obviously, with a 30-hour screening, there's a certain element of what time of the day those episodes drop is
right,
part
sure.
of it. But one of the, I'd say probably the 3 episodes that hit the most was an episode I'm a really big fan of that you wrote and directed, which is the closer of season 1.
Right.
Now, I was wondering, were the multiple cliffhangers in that episode, and I may be reading too much into this, I get accused of this a lot, but were they, because I've always thought that they felt to me as if they were almost a satirical comment on the nature of, I suppose, the soap opera or serialized television, just because of almost the insanity of the amount of them. Is there any sort of, am I warm on that?
Yeah, no, you're very warm. I mean, that was very conscious on my part. The funny thing about the first season that we did, which was the pilot in those first 7 episodes, they were kind of produced in a vacuum. You know, no major audience had ever seen the pilot prior to it airing, the following year. So we were kind of creating a 9-hour pilot, so to speak, to argue for why we should be on the air. And I felt all along that we were following on the heels of a lot of really silly television shows. That was the era and the decade of the nighttime soap, with shows like Dallas and Dynasty and Falcon Crest and Knots Landing and all these over-the-top Douglas Sirk-like melodramas.
I mean, I think that's something that's difficult for even people younger than myself to relate to, is that was what television was in 1989.
Right. So there was a very much an element of satire and sending up and tweaking that kind of silly tendency. But it was also, it was in a way insurance to pile on as many of those endings as I could possibly think of, in order to prompt the network to bring us back, that, you know, they would have to, hoping that the hue and cry would be so great that things were left in such a state that people would demand to know what had happened in all those stories. So it was a strategic decision as well as an artistic one. And sure enough, you know, the strategy worked, and that episode does seem to still resonate for people.
When, as I mentioned earlier on, my first experience was renting the VHS of the pilot episode, and I was confused and thrilled and surprised when I saw that this interesting film that I watched was going to a TV series. And I always recall seeing a bus shelter advert for Twin Peaks when it was first shown on the BBC, and it was just a black background, and it just said, "Twin Peaks, it's about secrets." And the simplicity of that was so tantalizing. Now, on the subject of secrets, what was it? I mean, I ask you this almost on more of a sort of personal level than as a writer or as a showrunner. But what was it like being one of the secret keepers to Laura's murder? Because I'd imagine that must be an incredibly powerful feeling.
Well, it was a kind of a nervous feeling in a way. David and I did effectively keep the secret. From everybody, including all the actors, any of our significant others, our families. We didn't reveal it to anybody, not even the actors. You've probably heard the story that on the day that we shot the scenes in which it was revealed, we very quietly brought three actors into our offices and told each of them that they were the killer, and then proceeded to shoot a scene with them.
This is pre-internet as well, isn't it? Where, I mean,
right.
I mean, the level of secrecy now, I mean, that would be completely unmanageable, I'd have thought.
Yeah, there would be so many ways in which that could sneak out now. It's almost impossible to envision. You know, the show, when it hit, was actually kind of my introduction to the internet. I mean, I was an early, I got onto email pretty quickly, and I was interested in the internet. I'd always been fond of computers, but somebody I remember during that first season came in and plucked down about a 500-page stack of internet forums in which people were discussing the show. And I realized that we had struck a nerve.
But did you never have a moment where you thought, I know this. I know these secrets. Was there? I mean, I appreciate, obviously, on a practical level, it must have been very stressful and difficult, particularly, obviously, when you're dealing with actors who are concerned about their job. I mean, Ray Wise has talked about his feelings, obviously, in relation to that. But was there? I mean, I think I'm maybe sort of revealing more about myself here. But I mean, I can't help but think that I just feel sort of, I don't know, kind of almost a level of smugness, knowing that this was a question that most of the Western world and beyond wanted the answer to.
It was more a feeling of astonishment to me that people could be that interested. You know, I'd been writing my whole life and written lots of different kinds of stories, and the idea that a thing like this could grab hold of a nation and mesmerize it so was a lesson in how powerful storytelling can be, and how much we as I guess, as human beings and as societies, still can be enraptured by that come sit around the campfire and let me tell you a story feeling. That
the whole world was looking through that keyhole with Audrey Horne for a while there, weren't they?
Yeah, it was primal. You know, there was something that we tapped into that that really reinforced the almost genetic power of storytelling to the human soul. It was a remarkable experience, and I think all of us who were involved with the show were touched by it on that level, that we felt this is what storytelling is supposed to be. It's supposed to feel this compelling. You're supposed to be this drawn to it, and it has a kind of power that's very hard to explain, even when you're the one telling the story. There was an equation there that we were all a part of that felt very unifying. And it was an experience that I know none of us who were in the middle of it will ever forget.
I put out a tweet earlier on asking for some questions, and one of the ones that I've got here from, and it's kind of connected to this, from TGP73, was how far into the show's run did you know that it was Leland?
Well, David and I have talked about this. I think we knew in the back of our minds when we were writing the pilot. I don't think we knew consciously until we actually had to shoot the closed ending for that first go round. Mm-hmm. Then that forced us to really ask ourselves, what are we getting at here? And what is this really about? And even though the ending that we came up with was complete misdirection, it did prompt us to really sit down and think that out. And then by the time we got into shooting that first season, we were pretty clear about it with each other from the start.
So at what point in the chronology of the show did you ever actually say it out loud to each other?
I would say when we were writing the first episode of the first season, and I'm trying to remember, that was just a single hour, wasn't it? It was a 2-hour in the second year. But when we came back, and it had been over a year since we'd made the pilot, and actually sat down and started writing that first season, it was at that time, I think, we looked at each other and said, wow, this is who did it.
I mean, we all know the story and the fallout and, you know, arguably the consequences of the pressure to reveal the killer. But when did that begin? When did the pressure to wrap up the Laura Palmer storyline begin? Or was it just there constantly? Or was it at the end of the first season? I mean, can you kind of pinpoint that?
I think it was in the network's minds from the beginning that they had misgivings about even doing a serialized program from the beginning, and certainly about leaving the mystery unresolved. They were lobbying very strongly for us to solve it by the end of that first series, by the ninth hour.
And so was their understanding that you would do a mystery of the season sort of structure, or I mean, did they give you a rationale?
Well, in that we'd only had a partial pickup, you know, for the first year. That was my argument to them, was that, yeah, we can do one mystery per year, but we haven't had a full year yet. So don't expect us to give you the answer to this right away, like you're, you know, a hungry kid asking for an ice cream cone. We solved it, 9 hours into the second season, which would have been roughly, you know, the length of a full American television season. So that timing seemed about right. Now, David did argue, and as I've said in other places, I've come around to thinking that he may well have been right, that we could have held on to that secret a little longer, that people would have stood still for that. I think all you have to do is look at the 6 years that Lost spent on the air and say, yeah, people were willing to wait an awfully long time to get some answers.
That's the problem with being ahead of your time, though, isn't there? Is that there's no infrastructures for these things.
Yeah, no, and it was, we were very much ahead of it in that regard. And so the compromise was that let's solve it halfway through that first year. And I think the part of the downfall of the show was not getting a quick enough ramping up of whatever that next story was going to be to match the intensity and the focus that we'd had in the original series. And I think if we were to do it again, we would do it differently. We would have let it go on a little bit longer. We might have let one story lead to the next a little bit more smoothly. And we might have even delayed the reveal of who killed her for quite some time. It's hard to say. You obviously can't go back and rewrite it at this point. But it did hurt us in the second half of the second season.
Okay, Mark, I'm going to put you on the spot here. Was Bob real or was Leland crazy?
Yes. I think to both. Seriously, I think the answer is yes to both. I think that if you've ever had experience of people who are truly, utterly mad, schizophrenic or psychotic or delusional in that way, the idea to them of there being an entity inside them is utterly real. That they are not lone actors in their story, that they are possessed in some way by something that is too deep and dark for them to comprehend. And this is an image that comes from the depths and the dregs of human history, not just modern life. But the idea that you are possessed by something other than yourself was there in early man. It was there in medieval iconography. It's there in the early days of Freud and Jung, that there are supposedly we have what they sometimes call monsters of the id that cause us to do things that we might not otherwise do. So that's not me trying to have it both ways. That's me saying that was our point of view on it, that the kind of madness that had possessed him has a long and frightening history in the human animal, and it's very easy to explain it in modern psychological terms. I mean, think about the ending of Psycho, for instance, where they try to reassure the audience that with this very clinical description of what had gone wrong inside of Anthony Perkins.
Do you really want 5 minutes of psychoanalytical exposition at the end of your story to clarify these things, or do you want to leave it as this beautiful mystery?
Right. I mean, that was our choice. You can either explain it one way or you can explain it the other, or you can put it out there and let people decide for themselves.
On a connected note, I've recently read your original draft that I believe, I think it maybe was with Harley Payton and Bob Engels, where of the final episode of Twin Peaks. Now, when I went to university, this was several years after the show had finished, I went to university as a mature student and I was studying a film degree. And one of the first things I said to all of my housemates who were several years younger than me was, have you seen Twin Peaks? And they were like, no. So we sat down and watched it. And I was doing that annoying thing that all movie nerds do, where I was watching the people in the room watching the show more than I was actually engaging it myself. And we got to the end of the penultimate episode. We got to the end of the Miss Twin Peaks pageant. And they were like, great, we're going to get this last episode. And I was like, okay, guys, I've got to warn you. You're going to want to phone your mother and tell her you love her after this, because it's going to get brutal now. I read the original draft that you wrote of this, and I'm curious, a bit of a loaded question is, what do you think of the changes made to the final episode as co-scripted by yourself once David became involved in it? I mean, in your version, there seemed to be more sort of, I suppose, Arthurian imagery in it. What were your feelings when you saw that?
Well, it's the same feeling I'd always had, which was that was an instance where I was completely comfortable letting David run with the ball. That what we gave him in that particular instance was a blueprint. And his instincts had always been so sharp and so so formidable in what he brought to the show that I was more than okay with letting him take it off in that direction. I mean, the image that I always had in mind, and mind you, we didn't know at the time that that was going to be the last hour. We had still had held out, you know, pretty high hopes that ABC would renew us for another season.
Well, those cliffhangers were in there again, weren't they?
Yeah, that was the kind of the reason for that, and that I wanted. I remember telling David, just, you know, amp this up as much as you want. Take it wherever you need to take it. Let's really give. If we're going to go out, let's go out with a bang. And so I felt he lived up to that. You know, he created something deep and dark and very dangerous in those final minutes. And I think they're still frightening today.
I always find it fascinating to observe people's reactions to that episode. I mean, the first thing that surprised me was I'd always heard in, you know, Twin Peaks fandom, the differences between. But I mean, the thing that surprised me the most, reading original script, was that the fundamentals aren't actually really that different. It's narratively, it's a lot more faithful to the script than I was imagining from what I'd heard. And one of the things that I've heard people say, and I'm curious to get your opinion on this, was it felt like David in his direction, and also in the script as well, that you were kind of burning the show down. There's a lot of anger in that last episode. Now,
yeah,
was that just a narrative necessity because it was the end of the season and we were going into these more the surrealistic was becoming the literal in the world of the show, or was there an element of, well, we may not get to do this again, so let's just have a hootenanny?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of both there, and the show that always comes to mind when I think about this, and it was always a seminal influence for me, just in general, and also in the particular about how far you can push a narrative television show, and that's the last episode of The Prisoner.
Of course.
Where McGoohan had taken everything he'd done and completely turned all your expectations on their heads.
I mean, he virtually had to leave the country after that episode aired.
He was
freaked out and angry and just blown away by that.
But I mean, in retrospect, it was a very brave choice, and what he was saying, ultimately, I think had its fullest expression in that. And that episode, and I think you could look also at the end of The Sopranos in the same way, where I think David Chase ended the show brilliantly, in a way that created a lot of dissatisfaction in certain people who wanted something a little bit more neat and tidy. And you know, those two things stand out to me as maybe my favorite endings of great television series, and I have to say that, you know, if there's never another minute of Twin Peaks ever created, it's a pretty spectacular way to have gone out.
It's interesting. I mean, you've just answered my next question, because I mean, I was going to say to you, does Twin Peaks feel as a show unfinished to you? Because I mean, personally, I've always felt that it's as closed as it should be, because first of all, I mean, just on the level of satirizing soap operas, which I don't want to reduce Twin Peaks to just being a satire of soap operas, but soap operas as a genre, they resist closure. That's their very nature.
Right.
And I think that to have an ending for Twin Peaks it's just incongruous to the entire form that it presents, and the circular nature that's represented literally in many cases in the show.
Yeah, I think to tie everything up patly and neatly with a ribbon would have been a much greater betrayal of what we'd set out to do. And you know, there was that level of where we were making fun of a certain kind of storytelling, but we were also trying to do other things as well and push the power of what you could do in a continuing narrative and weave reality and mythology in ways that you hadn't seen a lot on television and give it a kind of density that most television doesn't possess. I mean, what I would tell every director who came in, and we worked with a lot of really talented people who'd come in to do the episodes, it wasn't the usual, okay, here's this week's traffic cop who's going to just, you know, make the cars go in the right direction. I was trying to instill in them, we're making little movies here, and we want you to leave your imprint, to make your movie. And that's, I think, in part why the series has lasted, that it wasn't a commodity that was disposable, that was there to sell advertising. We were taking it kind of seriously on the level of craft and storytelling. And if we were ever to go back to it, I'm sure it would be in a much different form than what we have seen already. But that doesn't mean that there's not more to say. It's just that I think what we were going to say 20 years ago was probably largely said. And I think the fact that it's still resonating for people probably confirms that.
Well, I'm very aware of the fact that I'm sort of eating into your day here, so I'm going to start wrapping things up here. But as I mentioned earlier on, I put a tweet out earlier on asking for a few questions. So if I had a tweet from Dude Files that you've already sort of partially answered, where he asked, do you ever see yourself and or David revisiting this world? Have you ever sort of received offers, or have there ever been, is it something that you feel quite precious about?
Well, it would really be up to David and I together. It would be a joint decision, and we've sat down periodically over the years and talked about a number of different things. And if it's going to happen, it won't be because of outside influences. It'll come out of our desire to do something else, and that decision hasn't been made. So we'll have to wait and see.
I've also heard that that you and I believe David as well have written a foreword to a re-release of Jennifer Lynch's Secret Diary of Laura Palmer. Now, are there plans to your knowledge for any more merchandise or releases?
That was prompted by the interest in the box set and the DVDs, and we felt that because it was such an important part of the process, and in fact kind of served as the basis for Fire Walk with Me, that it might be that people might like to see it again, because it's been out of print for a while. So that's where that came from. And having made that decision, it felt right to provide a kind of update and a perspective on where we are 20 years later.
I mean, anecdotally connected to that book, one of the things that made me realize personally what a phenomenon Twin Peaks was in the sort of 1990-91 was I was at college when it came out, and I remember going out to sit on the lawn in the front of my college summer afternoon, and I'd bought the Secret Diary of Laura Palmer, and I looked out and literally every other person was reading the Secret Diary of Laura Palmer. And I just remember walking around, and we got it a little bit earlier than probably we should have in the continuity of the show in relation to America. And I just remember the topic of conversation in the canteen at college that day going, who's this Bob that they're talking about? They're like, is this Bobby Briggs? Is this... And that's just something that's always haunting me. Fake Shemp and Hypnagoria. And this is actually probably the most common question that I've got, but is, will we see a List of Seven movie?
Ah, List of Seven. Well, List of Seven was the first novel I wrote not long after Twin Peaks, and was pretty successful at the time. And it was kind of an early example of what's now sort of thought of as the steampunk movement, although that wasn't something I consciously set out to do. And we've come close three times to making the movie, twice with Guillermo del Toro attached. Each time we've had a problem at the last minute with casting or scheduling. Jim Cameron was involved to produce it at one point. This was before Guillermo had even done a a film in America yet. Mm-hmm. It remains to be seen, because the launching of the Sherlock Holmes franchise with Robert Downey may have taken the wind out of our sails a little bit, since this deals with Arthur Conan Doyle and the kind of creation of Holmes, but not Holmes himself. So I don't know. We'll see. It's been a frustration of mine that we've never gotten it to the big screen, but I'm still hoping.
Okay, my penultimate Twitter question here from Dude Files, my friend Mark, who came with me to the aforementioned Battersea Arts Centre 30-hour Twin Peaks-a-thon, has asked, being the ever-sensitive lad that he is, does it bother you that it is often referred to as David Lynch's Twin Peaks?
No, not at all. It's just a misapprehension. David's never claimed credit for it entirely by himself, and the people that write the checks don't make that distinction. So I'm perfectly fine with my part of the legacy and how it's, and the credit that I've gotten for it, and not in the slightest.
What do you think is the show's influence and legacy? I mean, I know what the show's influence and legacy is, but I'm curious to see what your feelings are in relation to that.
Well, I think certainly in terms of network television, we kind of kicked some doors open that opened their minds to the idea that there might be different ways to tell stories than the kind of formulas that they've been following for a couple of decades up to that point. I think it also speaks to people's hunger, a fundamental hunger for things that go below the surface, that don't deal just in the glittering realities of shiny fake characters, that they want something deeper that speaks to things inside them that maybe they can't express, but they felt a resonance to things that they saw on the show, and it drew them in. And I guess if you were going to say what that was, it might be, I don't know, emotional truth. I mean, something that was a little bit more real or more powerful or more vivid than what they were used to seeing. I think that's a hallmark of good storytelling. And it can take a myriad of forms, but you know it when you see it. It's hard to describe. And there's no one way that it has to manifest. It doesn't happen very often in television, because the vicissitudes of time and schedule and pressure are so enormous that they usually just crush the creativity. But we were able to get to do it with the show, and the fact that it stood the test of time so far kind of reinforces that. And that's a very gratifying thing to see, and it's confirmation of what we had hoped to do when we started, which was to create something that would last.
What a great way to end. So thank you very much, Mark, for joining me and talking about Twin Peaks, the show that is the most beautiful dream and the most terrible nightmare. Mark, you have a website, you have a Twitter account. Would you like to tell our listeners how they can reach you?
Absolutely. I'm on Twitter at mfrost11. Happy to chat with anybody at any time. And you can visit my website, which visits all of the stuff that I've done, all the books I've written, the movies I've done, and obviously Twin Peaks, at bymarkfrost.com. And you'll see any coming news of new projects there.
Well, again, I'd like to thank you for making this 30-something nerd incredibly happy by joining me on my silly little podcast.